In part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. 352-5700. Nobody sells more real estate than RE/MAX, and they encourage you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about volcanoes, among the most dramatic and most destructive events in nature, something that here in the Midwest we don't think very much about. In fact, probably most Americans don't. But the fact of the matter is that volcanoes have been indeed very destructive. They've destroyed entire cities and forests. They can have effects on global climate. And around the world, there are hundreds of potentially active volcanoes capable of posing a major threat at any time. And while we certainly have over time learned a lot more about volcanoes and how they work, it is the fact that we're still a long way from having a reliable system to warn of an eruption. We thought we'd talk a little bit about volcanoes. I guess we've been thinking about it ever since the recent eruptions at Mount St. Helens, and we'll be doing that this morning with our guest, William Rose. He is professor of petrology at Michigan Technological University. That's in Houghton, Michigan. And he's been there at Michigan Tech for some time. He's also been a senior visiting scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, also at the Cascade Volcano Observatory. That's in Vancouver, Washington, at the Volcanological Survey of Indonesia, and also at the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. So he's been studying volcanoes for some time. And there at the university, he teaches courses in meteorology and also volcanology, and is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, you should feel free to pick up the telephone and join us if you have questions for our guest. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. Again, locally here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Rose, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
You're welcome.
We certainly appreciate it. Maybe I should ask you first for a definition, because for me, petrology is a new term. This is the first that I have come across. I know what geology is. What is petrology?
Petrology is just the science of rocks. And, one of the central things that geologists do is they do what we call reading rocks, and that is every rock is different if you look at it hard enough, and it records its history of formation. And so what petrologists do is look at the details of rocks, the various minerals that are present in the rocks, and the size and shapes and the history of their formation, and then we use it to infer conditions at the time of their formation, to look into the past. So in that sense, they're sort of like a fossil. And volcanology started out with lots of petrologists, and so that was a lot of my training was in petrology. I don't actually do that much petrology anymore, but I'm still a professor of petrology, and I teach that area. It's part of volcanological science.
Okay. Well, I guess the place to start maybe is to talk in basic terms about volcanoes. And I think probably if we ask people, can you tell us what a volcano is, they would have images in their mind of some of the famous eruptions. Maybe they'd think of Mount St. Helens, or they'd think of Mount Vesuvius or something like that. And they do have this understanding, I think, that at some point below the surface of the earth, conditions are such that rock exists in a molten form, and that somehow it manages to find a way to get to the surface, and that what happens is that over time pressure builds up, and eventually it's enough to cause this melted rock to be ejected, to be fired out through the surface, and it comes out in the form of a volcano, and it spews out, and there's a big cloud, and there may be fire, and there'll be a lot of smoke, and then there'll be this melted rock that will run down. At least, you know, we've seen that. Is that a good definition of what a volcano is?
Well, I think of people have different definitions. Some people say that a volcano is the place where a material comes from the depth of the earth. But I like to think of it as an entire plumbing system that includes all of the deposits of material on the surface, all the rocks that have come to the surface, which really the business part of the thing is the connection between the surface and wherever the liquid rock comes from. Mm-hmm. And so usually that goes down tens of kilometers from the surface. And that's the scientifically interesting part, because we don't know very much about what's under the ground, and we have to infer it indirectly. We can't go there easily. People have tried to drill into these sorts of places, but there's obvious problems associated with that. And so mostly we try to get information about that plumbing system by careful measurements of all sorts. And so what volcanologists do is they go to the sites of volcanic activity and try to design, I guess you'd call it an uncontrolled experiment. You take things with you to make measurements and observations with, and then you try to take advantage of what's happening at that particular point. So you have to go to the source for these kinds of experiments.
Hmm. I guess that in part what I was thinking about is that all volcanoes are not mountains, that they don't have to be, and I guess that all volcanic activity is not necessarily explosive, and it doesn't. It's not. They're not all like Mount St. Helens, for example.
Yeah, that's right. There's a big variety. Some volcanoes are holes, and because what's basically happened is that at the place of the eruption, so much material was erupted, and it was erupted so explosively that the volcano fell in on itself and produced a big hole. And so that's sort of one end member. And another end member would be a volcano, let's say, with activity like Stromboli, which has been active virtually every day for 3,000 years at least, and in which most of its activity is fairly Pacific. It just produces spatter, material that doesn't go very far from the vent. And so tourists can go alarmingly close to these things and get their thrills from it without every day putting themselves in danger. They wouldn't necessarily know when there was danger there. That's one of the issues about these things. Very calmly erupting volcanoes can be suddenly dangerous. So.
There are two active volcanoes in the United States, Kilauea and Mount St. Helens. Is that right?
Well, it's always hard to decide what an active volcano is, but certainly those two are actively erupting now, and I'm not sure where there are other volcanoes in the U.S. with an open vent where active eruption is taking place. There's a seismic crisis at Spur Volcano in Alaska, which is being watched, and so there's an expectation that it could become active on short notice. And then there are dozens of potentially active volcanoes in the Aleutian Islands, and only some of them are monitored. And so there could be eruptive activity occurring in parts of the Aleutian Islands that, at least at a low level, that we wouldn't know about. Certainly if there was a significant eruption, Alaska Volcano Observatory would have knowledge of it because we have satellite sensors and various tools to find out about activity. And we can usually do it if it's a significant eruption, even if the volcano isn't monitored. So maybe about somewhere around a third of the potentially active volcanoes in the world are monitored. And so we know a little bit more about those. And the unmonitored ones can be active without us knowing it.
I came across a figure, and I guess now I'm looking for it, trying to see if I still have it, for the number of potentially active volcanoes in the world now. And as I recall, it was in the hundreds. It might have been, could it be as many as 600?
Yeah, I think some people say 900. Mm. It's difficult to make this kind of a list. I mean, a volcano is like a sleeping animal, but an animal that sleeps for an incredibly long time. And so many volcanoes have reposes, we call them. They're sleeping periods, which last centuries or millennia. And so there are potentially active volcanoes which have had no historic eruptions at all. And those are the ones that we're uncertain about because it takes a little bit of work around the volcano to establish when it was active. And that isn't done in all cases. So there are a limited number of volcanologists, and there's lots of work to do in general on lots of other things in the world, and so we just haven't gotten to understanding. So there's many volcanoes in the maybe category.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is William Rose. He's professor of petrology at Michigan Technological University. He studies volcanoes, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of the show. Questions are welcome. We have someone, in fact, who is ready with a question. Others can call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
How would you categorize Yellowstone? If that's not an active volcano, how would you categorize it? And what is the status of Yellowstone right now? I know a couple years ago when we were out there, they were talking about the warming of the lake and that there's a dome under the lake. Could you talk about Yellowstone, please? Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yellowstone would be certainly a volcano that's potentially active. It has had significant eruptions not in historic time, but over the past couple of million years, and some very profound eruptive events. And so the expectation is that it will erupt again. There's been the establishment of a volcano observatory there in the park, and there's an effort by the United States Geological Survey and associated university partners at making measurements of what we call the unrest of the volcano. So you could say this is the breathing in the sleep of the volcano, or that it might be the signs of the volcano waking up. Volcanoes like Yellowstone we call them calderas. They're the, what I mentioned before, the kind of volcano that has a hole present in it that has very explosive events. Usually they happen after long periods of repose. And so the Yellowstone volcano has had very large explosive events hundreds of thousands of years ago. And the repose interval that it has is of the order of hundreds of thousands of years. We expect another large event like that, but we also expect smaller unrest events. And so the thing that's being observed, you know, under Yellowstone Lake and the possible signs of intrusion of a dome extrusion might be one of the forms of activity that would be less profound and significant if it happened. And so people should realize that activity is likely of Yellowstone, but the probability in any year is quite low. So we don't have any evidence that suggests there's going to be an eruption in the next year or two, and that might be the length of time in which we'd have a good signal or some idea of an eruption coming, at least at the present state of understanding of these kinds of things. So large eruptions like Yellowstone sometimes has had in the past are very significant events, and they would have effects all over North America and probably all over the world. We know something about these effects. There are people doing quiet research about this, not to alarm people, because the probability is of an event happening in the next short time frame is low. But we're interested in how the world and the continent and so on might prepare for an event like that, because we might get a year or two's warning. And what are the things that we should do to prepare for these kinds of events? That's one of the areas of intense research that's going on. Hmm. So Yellowstone is it's an object of lots of research.
All right, let's talk with someone else. We have someone from a cell phone there on the road. We'll go there, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to just ask two questions and then hang up and listen. The first one is, what are the manifestations of a volcanic eruption in the middle of the ocean? Are they sometimes the causes of things like tsunamis and any other weather effects that then come to the mainland? And the second question is there any connection that people have established between earthquakes and volcanoes, one causing the other, or any causal connection at all? And if there is, how does that affect what would be most relevant to us in the Midwest, which would be, I don't know what it's called, the Great Madrid Fault Line, because we've had minor earthquakes through here in the last even 30 years. Does that have anything at all to do with volcanoes anywhere? I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, eruptions in the ocean, if it's in the shallow ocean, then what can happen is that the explosive events actually penetrate the ocean surface, and you can have an eruption in which the ocean water is one of the agents. The ocean actually evaporates and helps promote the fragmentation of the formerly liquid rock. And so in 1994 at Rabaul in Papua New Guinea, there was an eruption like this where the ocean actually flowed into the vent of the volcano. And so most eruptions in an oceanic environment are either on islands, which means that they're above the ocean level, or they're completely underwater. And if an eruption happens in the deep ocean, there often is no surficial penetration of the eruption phenomena. And what might happen is there might be overturn of deep water in the ocean, or a rising of a hot plume of the ocean, and just a perturbation, you know, within the water surface from the eruption, and the lava material would be erupted under the surface and would cool against the water and form pillow lavas and sometimes fragmental rocks underneath the surface, but we wouldn't see much at the surface. You're right about tsunami. Tsunami happened from oceanic events and also from surficial events on islands, where any place where there's a collapse of material or where there might be landslides or debris flows of materials that would flow into the ocean generate tsunami. And let's see. Your other question was about earthquakes and volcanoes and the causal relationship. I think it's possible to say that virtually every volcanic event has some kind of earthquake associated with it, and seismology is the tool that is most commonly used. That, I mean, seismology is a methodology for measuring and detecting, measuring, locating earthquakes, and it's the number one tool that we use to monitor volcanic unrest. We look at the pattern of earthquake events, and some of these earthquakes are very much like earthquakes that occur in places like, well, far away from from volcanoes. In other words, they have a seismic signal that looks like other earthquakes. They represent just the breaking of the ground and the formation of a fault, sliding of rocks against the surface, and they're associated with the volcanic phenomena because the magma rising toward the surface is breaking its way through brittle crustal materials. But before eruptions, we get characteristic kinds of seismic events that are associated with other phenomena like the movement of lava through a crack or the formation of bubbles in the rising magma, the sort of Coke bottle effect that's associated with depressurization of the magma as it rises to the surface. And so we use earthquake monitoring, and especially the location and intensity patterns that are associated with them, to try to forecast what's going to happen. But there are many areas on Earth, like New Madrid, where there are earthquakes, but we don't expect to see volcanic activity. So this is seismic activity that happens because of stresses on the Earth's crust that are taking place and because of the formation of faults and so on, but there is no history of volcanic activity associated with these faults. And so volcanoes always have some kinds of earthquakes associated with them, but every earthquake area is not a volcanic area.
All right, let's talk again with another caller. Next up is Belgium, over by Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I'd like to continue on a little bit of a question about the undersea aspect. You're totally aware of the Mid-Atlantic fault ridge line that seems to be pushing Europe and Africa farther away from North America and South America. Now, this is a spreading of the Earth's crust there. Is that the only place that there is such a spreading, or is there such a thing in the Pacific Ocean or the Indian Ocean or something like that?
Yes, there are these ridges. They occur in all the oceans, even in the Arctic Ocean. And so there's the East Pacific Rise, and there's a spreading center actually very close to the west coast of the U.S., the so-called Juan de Fuca Ridge, where there are active eruptions occurring and where people observe them also with submersibles. The people at the University of Washington make regular observations along the Juan de Fuca Ridge. So this is a part of Well, you know, volcanoes represent the places where we have material coming from the deep earth. And these great ocean ridges, like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, these are long lines of volcanic vents, basically. And so the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, started as two pieces of the continent, Africa and South America, close together, and a long crack formed. And then slowly, we're talking centimeters per year is the rate of spreading of these phenomena. So most of the time, at any particular point on the ridge, there's no activity. But the ridges open up. We've had recently eruptions in Iceland. Iceland is one of the parts of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge that we can see better because it's on land. There's been so much volcanism at those points along the ridge that it has built itself out of the water. And so there we can see the cracks going across Iceland, and we can observe the frequency of eruptions that take place there. And so there was an eruption just a month or so ago in Iceland, under the ice in Iceland. So it wasn't as easily observed as superficial eruptive events.
I see. Now then, if all these different places are spreading, obviously someplace it has to be being chewed up. what happened? Where's that at?
Yeah, well, that's another site where we find volcanoes is where there is what we call subduction. And so what happens on the frequently happens at the boundary of continents and oceanic crust is a place where the thinner crust of the ocean basin gets pushed underneath the continent. So this happens all along the Andes, for example, of South America and underneath Central America and Mexico. The ocean crust, which is made up of lava flows, basically with sediments on top of them, lava flows that came from activity at the spreading center, is getting pushed down along a seismic zone, dipping at a high angle, and getting pushed right underneath the continent. So these are zones of where there are very, very severe earthquake activity and where there are tends to be explosive volcanism. The volcanism is more explosive because the material that goes down in these subduction zones underneath Central America, underneath South America, is loaded with water. It's basically water that comes from the sea and which is preserved in sediments, and this material gets pushed down into the hotter and hotter earth below it, and it emerges. It gets dehydrated. This rock gets dehydrated. The water moves upward, and it fluxes melting. It causes melting to take place underneath the countries of Central and South America. And so you have a line of volcanoes that is the result of this melting process. And these volcanoes tend to be explosive because they have so much water that has come from the ocean that the magma that rises toward the surface is very gas-rich. And so it tends to be explosive. So volcanoes that occur at these kinds of what we call convergent plate boundaries, these are the places where the crust is being consumed rather than spreading, these tend to be more explosive because they have more gas.
Then would Mount St. Helens be one of those spots?
Yes, Mount St. Helens is an example of this kind of volcano where the crust from the ocean, from the Pacific Ocean, is being pushed underneath the Cascade Mountains. And so we're generating magma from a depth of, say, 100 kilometers below the surface, and it's working its way through the surface and getting stored in magma storage systems, and then eventually emerging, at least in the case of the eruption of 1980, when it erupted, it contained lots of gas and was highly explosive. Now, and after that explosive event, the magma tends to be degassed. It's lost a lot of its zip, and so it isn't so highly explosive as it was at first.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Just that gets at one of the questions that I want to make sure we talked a little bit about. And as I explained at the beginning of the program, I think probably the point at which we started thinking it might be interesting to talk about volcanoes was earlier this fall when there was some activity and last month and the month before at Mount St. Helens. And I'm sure that a lot of people out there in the area, people who remember that eruption in May of 1980 and just how destructive it was, must have been concerned about the possibility that something like that could happen again. Do you think, it sounds as if you're saying the consensus is of people who study it that probably an eruption like that would not happen again, or perhaps it would not happen anytime soon?
Well, an eruption like that will happen again, but we're not thinking that it's going to happen in the short time frame, but people are watching it. I think that people should realize that the eruption that started in early October and actually started with events in September, it was noticed well in advance. So September 23rd really is the date when most people think this event happened. But it's still going on. There is hot magma coming to the surface right at this moment, and the eruption continues. If you check with the observational data from the U.S. Geological Survey, you can look on the web, and you can get information right up to the moment. I checked it this morning. The eruption is still going on. There is the extrusion of magma forming a new lava dome at the surface. It isn't such a big deal as it was at first, because frequently when the magma just breaks through the surface, there is disruption and some explosivity associated with the opening of the vent. You could think of the vent of the volcano. Well, you can think of it like a tube of toothpaste, and how sometimes it might be crusty on the outer surface, and so you have to squeeze a little bit to get the toothpaste flowing, especially if you don't put the cap on it. So that's what happened at the beginning of the eruptive event. The conduit, what we call the tube, the top of the toothpaste, the narrow neck, there had to be cleaned so that material can flow through it relatively smoothly. And so what's happening now is it's an open vent. It's extruding somewhat quietly. There are gas emissions that take place. There are small ash clouds that rise associated with this, but it isn't rising to thousands of feet like it was for a few days in October. And so the public may sense that the eruption is over, but it's not over. And so as long as you have an open vent volcano, there's the possibility that the conditions of the eruptive phenomena might change. And so that's why there's a lot of observations taking place, seismic observations, deformation, gas measurements that are taking place, and measurements of the change in the size of the dome and the form of the dome, and temperature measurements on the surface of the dome to see the pattern at which it's changing. And so there's a lot of effort made at looking at a potentially dangerous volcano, especially when it's in an open vent condition like this. So this event is an object of great interest, and people evaluate data continually every day, and you don't hear about it unless there's a change, really, in the interpretation. And the current interpretation about these things is that this activity might continue for weeks or months or even years, and it's not going to have serious effects on people except in the very immediate vicinity, areas which are already have fairly tight controls. It's a national monument, and so the access of the public to dangerous areas can be easily controlled without inconveniencing people from their daily lives.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, William Rose, is professor of petrology at Michigan Technological University and is interested in studies volcanoes, and that's what we're talking about. A little bit about Mount St. Helens, but also more generally about volcanoes and how they work and what scientists are doing to try to understand them better so that they can predict when they might erupt. Questions are certainly welcome. We have about 20 minutes left in this first hour of the show. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And we have a caller in Philo, line number one. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Yes, I'm going to be visiting Nicaragua and Honduras first couple weeks of January with the Nicaraguan fellow. I wonder if you had a suggestion about the most interesting volcanoes. I understand they have like 21 there. I think we're going to be seeing Mombacho, which is near Granada, and probably the Masaya one near the town called Masaya. They have national parks there for volcanoes. They have so many. Any suggestions as to what might be the most interesting one or two to take a look at?
Well, yes, there in Nicaragua there are several volcanoes that have frequent eruptive activity, and where even you might see eruptive events during a visit. Masaya is a drive-up volcano, so it's very near to the city of Managua, and it's a national park, and you can drive right to the crater rim and look down into the open vent of the volcano. It's a magnificent sight, and it's very easy to reach. You don't even have to walk very much, although you can take a beautiful walk around the summit region and look at it. It's quite an important volcano. It's a lot bigger than it appears to be, and it's an object of lots of scientific research because it has a very active gas plume. And this gas plume moves toward the Pacific Ocean, and it causes very dramatic effects on plants and also on people, really, because it has a health hazard and many particles in the plume, and it's full of acid kinds of material. So if you drive to the west of Masaya and go back into Managua, by that route you can go through the gas plume and experience the environmental issues. It's like an extreme pollutant plume, and it's a serious problem for that part of Nicaragua. But there are several other volcanoes that you could look at. There is San Cristobal, which is a beautiful large crater volcano. It's an extensive climb, and entry into the crater is a bit dangerous, but you could rise up to the summit and have a look into a fantastic crater. There's also Telica and Cerro Negro, which are two volcanoes also to the north of Managua that have very frequent eruptive events. And if you have a good vehicle, you can drive very close to Cerro Negro. It's a
We're going to have a four-wheel drive vehicle.
A small cinder cone. Telica is a little bit more of a production to get to. And there are other places, too. There's on Ometepe Island in the middle of Lake Nicaragua. There are very large volcanoes, especially Concepcion, a dangerous place, but a fantastically beautiful place. And so, but you can contract guides that will take you.
Yeah, I understand they have guides, and better take one. Somebody got lost and has never been seen. The big features there, I understand.
That's right. It can be dangerous if you don't know the way. And, you know, the weather's very changeable on volcanoes, but they are fantastic places to visit, and so I encourage you to do it with the help of local people who will mostly keep you out of trouble. And I think it's well worth having this kind of experience. Central America, there are many places in Central America where you can see active volcanoes. It's one of the places I've worked the most. In Guatemala, there are three actively erupting volcanoes right now. And
uh-huh.
So you could, if you were interested in volcanic activity, that's an excellent place to look at eruptive phenomena. Also in Costa Rica, there are erupting volcanoes, although not as active as the ones in Guatemala.
Yeah, well, we can't get over there. We are traveling with a Nicaraguan friend, and we'll be in Nicaragua and some in Honduras. But we plan to hit some in Nicaragua. I appreciate your information, though.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's continue.
Thank you.
Our next caller here is in Urbana, where we are. Line number two. Hello.
Yes, I'm interested in ideas about the relationship between volcanic eruptions and climate change. Could you speak a little bit about that? I'll listen off the air.
Yes, well, that's an area that I work a lot on. The of course, larger eruptions have more measurable effects, but in the past 25 years, we've had two eruptions which have had a demonstrable worldwide climatic effect. One was in 1982, the eruption of a volcano called El Chichon, which is in Mexico. And the second was in 1991 in the Philippines, the Pinatubo eruption. And explosive volcanic eruptions release a lot of gas and a lot of ash. And they also, there also is a lot of ice in the volcanic clouds that form from these events. And because the material is hot, it rises a long way into the atmosphere. Some of it penetrates into the stratosphere. And the sulfur dioxide, that's one of the gaseous components that's released, converts to aerosol particles. They're actually sulfuric acid, so sulfur dioxide reacts with the atmosphere, forms sulfuric acid, which forms tiny droplets. And these tiny droplets stay in the stratosphere for a long time, and they influence the incoming energy from the sun, which is very important to heat the atmosphere and keep us warm. And so when these sulfate particles collect in the stratosphere, the solar radiation input to the Earth that warms us every day is inhibited. And so the upper atmosphere heats up and the surface of the Earth cools. And so we've measured significant worldwide temperature changes that happened from these two eruptions in 1982 and 1991. And these temperature effects lasted for about 3 years. And both of these eruptions were fairly small in scale, certainly tiny compared to a Yellowstone eruptive event. And so this is one of the concerns we have about large eruptions, is that the temperature changes that occurred in the case of these two eruptions, it was only a degree or two at the most. And so that the temperature effects that would happen in a much larger event might be much more, and they might last longer. And so this concerns us. We're thinking about whether there are eruptions large enough, for example, to affect a growing season and the food that is produced on a worldwide basis, for example. And so we've looked at historic events like Krakatoa and the Tambora eruption of 1815, and we've looked at the climate effects on a worldwide basis from those events, which were larger than these two that happened in recent history. We tend to study the recent events more because we have more data sources that take place. There's lots of satellite data which we can use to make measurements of the amounts of ash, the amounts of ice, the amounts of sulfur dioxide, the amount of sulfate in these eruptive events, and so we can look at where they are in the atmosphere and how they get distributed as a result of the eruption. And so we see a lot of details like this, but there's still a need to understand what happens in larger and larger eruptive events, where there might be enormous amounts of ice, for example, in very large events, and what is the effect of all that ice in a kind of global cirrus cloud that would maybe have very profound effects on energy exchange from the sun and might affect us a lot more.
All right. Well, we have some other callers, and oh, pardon me, I jumped in on you. Were you not?
No, that's okay.
We're not finished. My apologies. I'm just thinking about the fact that we have about 6 or 7 minutes, and we have some other callers, and
sure.
I'd like to try to get them in too.
Sure.
So let's just go to Champagne, and believe that would be our next caller in line number three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm not a scientist, but I'm interested in knowing how the fire under the ocean crust or under the earth crust, what is the source of oxygen for that fire?
Well, a lot of what you see when magma comes to the surface appears to be fire, but it's not really fire. It's high-temperature liquid rock. When any material gets heated to temperatures more than 1,000 degrees C, it looks orange or red in color. And if you heat it hotter, it starts to looking white, what you call white hot. It's analogous to what happens on an electric stove when a burner goes on. And so when this material comes to the surface, what you see looks like fire, but it's really just high temperature material. The temperature comes from radioactivity in the earth. This is not radioactivity from nuclear bombs. This is natural radioactivity within the earth, and so the temperature everywhere on earth increases as you go down below the surface. And if you're in one of these special places on Earth at spreading centers or at the convergent plate boundaries, like where Mount St. Helens is located, then you have conditions where liquid rock can originate. So sometimes there are things that are real fires associated with volcanoes, and that happens when the oxygen from the atmosphere becomes involved and mixes with the gas, and you get combustion that takes place, or it happens when a lava flow flows over a forest, and the forest burns as a result of reaching its kindling temperature, and when oxygen from the atmosphere it gets oxidized. So it's not the main phenomena that occurs is not really a fire.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. To Bloomington, Indiana, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about Mount St. Helens. When Mount St. Helens erupted, when it exploded, I understand that some of the debris from that eruption created a temporary dam across the Toutle River. And then as the Toutle River rose behind that temporary dam, as the water got higher and higher, put more pressure on this temporary dam so that the dam collapsed. The water surged out, and it flowed so strongly that it cut a canyon along the riverbed, and it cut this canyon in just a few hours. Have I got that story anywhere near correct?
No, that's exactly right. Well, you know, the reason the dam formed is that the Mount St. Helens volcano collapsed as a result of the eruption. It was that was the most dramatic thing that took place. If you visited it recently, you'll notice that there's a like an amphitheater that's formed. It's open to the north. The north side of the volcano, before eruption, it bulged prominently, and the USGS scientists noticed the formation of this bulge in advance, but the effect at the very beginning of the eruption was that the bulge collapsed and the whole top of the volcano was transported several kilometers down the Toutle River Valley, and there were great big blocks of things hundreds of meters long, and some of these dammed the river channel. There was a huge volume of material, cubic kilometers of material, that moved much more than what was erupted explosively. And so it all went into the river valley because it went downhill. It followed gravity, as it must. And so the river, which was trying to find its former course, couldn't find its course, and so it produced a very large lake. And actually, there were many lakes. And so the control of the water buildup in these lakes was a serious issue, and it's very difficult to manage a sudden situation like this. So you had eventually a flood of the lake. The lake got higher and higher and higher and finally found a path where it quickly eroded this still loose material into a deep canyon, just as you said.
We are going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, because we've come to the end of the time. We'll just have to leave it there, just with the reminder that if people are interested in volcanoes and have internet access, there's lots and lots of information on the volcanoes. One place you might go is to the website of the U.S. Geological Survey, and from there, or you can also go look at the website of our guest. Go to Michigan Technological University. Our guest, William Rose, he's professor of petrology there. And Professor Rose, thanks very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Focus 580, our show made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast also made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet. Christie Clinic, medicine for your life. We're going to break for an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud.